You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
This is Kristen Farrig for the Art World Demystified, and I'm here with artist and curator Heather Nickel. Heather's shown her work in France, Germany, Canada, and the United States, and she just recently completed two major curatorial projects at Artscape Young Place. And Heather, welcome. Thank you.
Thanks.
So I have so many questions I'd like to ask you about your work, which covers such a huge span. How about if we just start with these two major projects at Young Place, and how did that happen and what was that about?
Okay. Well, we're sitting in the building now, and it is a repurposed public school in downtown Toronto. The school was one of several that were shut down during the Mike Harris administration, a conservative government here about 15 years ago, and they targeted schools with a formula that equated square foot per child. And sadly, that ended up inadvertently targeting historic buildings. This building has a fantastic hall. It had a huge foyer as well, grand stairways, all these amazing architectural features. The school had been closed and was boarded up. I moved here to Toronto in 2003, and I'd lived for many years in New York, and I'd had a studio in Long Island City for years, and of course frequently visited PS1, and so it was hard to walk by this building without sort of drooling at the potential space that it had inside it, and I always wanted to come in. So when I moved to Toronto, I started doing DIY curatorial projects, and I did one in a very large space where my old studio used to be. It was a 10,000 square foot warehouse that had been a sweatshop. They all moved out, and suddenly it was empty. And of course, I'm used to New York, so I'm thinking, oh my God, it's going to be Bruce Mao's new studio, or like something amazing is going to happen, but like nothing was happening. So it was sitting empty for months. So I approached the owners of the building and launched this project that had over 50 artists, and it was really successful. There's a big appetite in Toronto for these kinds of off-site things, as is evidenced by the huge success in the city of Nuit Blanche. So people in Toronto are really hungry and eager to see things, and there's a lot of amazing artists here as well. So that made me start wanting to get into this building even more after that event. And so I ended up approaching the Toronto District School Board and essentially renting the school as if I was doing... people rent school properties in Toronto to play sports or to Elections Canada. They have these formulas. So I had to rent it by the square foot by the day. It was quite crazy, but I was able to access it. And I did an intervention here that featured over 50 artists from all of the Toronto educational institutions, so U of T and York, OCAD University, etc., sort of gleaning through faculty artists. And so the show is called Art School Dismissed, and it sort of explored the pedagogic history of this building. And I thought it was really interesting to look at artists who extend their practices into the realm of education. But the building it looked like it had been just abandoned in time. It looked like some almost post-apocalyptic, really evocative space. And so with the widespread desire for artists to work site specifically, sometimes there's not very many opportunities in a way to dig your teeth into a great site. Mm. Well, this really offered that. So the work was amazing that the artists did. So fast forward a few more years. Now the building's been taken over by Artscape, which is a pretty exciting not-for-profit organization in Toronto that rose from a small thing where they rented large spaces and subdivided it out to help create workspace for artists. Now it's quite something. Listeners can look them up online. Tim Jones just won some huge international award. They're creative placemakers. It's a little bit in the sort of Richard Florida school of creative cities and all this kind of thing. They got the building and have repurposed it. It's had an enormous renovation, $17 million worth of renovating.
So they actually own the building.
They do now. Yeah. They, in fact, took ownership of it not that much after Art School Dismissed, which was in 2010. Mm-hmm. So it's been in their hands now for several years and this huge refurbishing has happened. They approached me to do the inaugural programming here. So it was really exciting for me to come back to the same space and reconsider it again now. Mm. The managing director had hoped that I would, suggested that maybe I work with some of the same artists and pick up on the same theme, which was an interesting thing for me to consider because, of course, in some ways it is the same place, but in many ways, of course, it's entirely different now. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about that as sort of the launching point for this show, like what makes a space and what makes it different and how do we try to hang on to history mm-hmm. during periods of huge upheaval, transformation, renovation, what have you. And I decided it would be, I found, the school has a long history here. So there, it started as a one-room schoolhouse in 1858 here. And this particular site is really rich in this history of the city as well as an educational institution. So they have an amazing archive, in fact. Mm. Now, when this school closed, a newer building had been annexed to it in the 50s. Which is really a sort of a dog, a little architectural dog beside a beautiful, majestic pony.
True, yes.
Horse. That school, the school moved into the little building. It's sort of awful. And so this enormous and really rich archive got jammed into their limited space over there. And in fact, I didn't even know it existed at the time that I did the first project. But Artscape had dug into this amazing archive. And so I decided to use that as the launching point. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about archives and the way what happens when we review them and when we crack them open. And then this whole idea of the catalytic moment of rediscovery of archival data.
Yes.
And also just the way things are collected, what gets saved, what stories are told through those decisions, and then how those are reinterpreted later. It's a really fascinating lens for looking at this building because, of course, it still feels in some ways like a school, but it doesn't.
No. You wouldn't have had access to the same space either in the second show because the classrooms were already made into studio spaces, or I think there's a theater as well, or performance space.
It's actually rehearsal spaces for the Center for Indigenous Theater.
Right.
They're beautiful spaces, but there isn't a proper theater per se. There was never a gym in the building, which is kind of fascinating. The school had an amazing history as a place of athletic prowess, and they won the citywide championships 51 years in a row and got a key to the city and all this crazy stuff. Because when the building was built in 1914, they didn't make gyms back in those days. The kids ran up and down the halls.
Yes.
So the archive is really amazing. It's full of all kinds of different treasures. For instance, all these trophies that they won over all those years. And many of them are quite valuable, like back to the 1800s, like silver, you know, goblets and so on. They were all just jammed into these cases on their sides. They were dislocated from their bases and the little figures had fallen off. Boxes and boxes and boxes of photos, class photos, team photos, every kind of scrapbook. And there was an old boys society that, raised money during the wars, all these kinds of things. So I invited initially four artists to come in and do, to look at that archive and use it as a springboard for new work.
Right. So this was, this second show was produced by Artscape.
Yes.
As sort of inauguration for the building.
That's correct.
Right.
So the ground floor of the building is, they've designed this thing called an urban lounge, which is a place for people to come from the city. There's Wi-Fi, and it's sort of a public space. It's not a train station or a hotel lobby. Mm. It's sort of just this weirdly neutral place for people to come. And there's four vitrines in it that they wanted me to program in as well. But other than that, there's all sorts of other stuff. There's it's quite busy. There's all sorts of shelving and neon signage and all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
So I decided to sort of anchor the show down there. At first I was going to call it Archive and Unarchive and just show archival material. Mm-hmm. But then in the end of the day, I'm a sculptor. I'm like my practice is interdisciplinary. So I move between making things, curating things, doing kind of large scale public kinds of things, and then creating sort of more intimate things in my studio. So my practice is quite varied. And I also have a background as an arts educator. So I did a master's at NYU back in 1990. And so going in the school over and over again and bringing the artists into the school and looking through the archive, of course, I then started to want to do something with it too. So I ended up working with kids at the school next door and making projects that stemmed directly from the archive. So that was kind of the idea of looking at the archive. Well, why do you save an educational or a school archive? It's to teach with.
Yes.
So the idea of these things as teaching tools became really interesting to me, and I was especially interested in this colonial story, really. Mm-hmm. The Givenshaw School, and this General Givens had fought in the Loyalist side of the War of 1812 and was awarded this huge tract of land upon which this all sits nowadays. Mm-hmm. But when you look at this really outrageous, really, from our contemporary language and understandings of history, there's a bronze plaque in front of the school that talks about his... you know, great victory as the leader of a band of Indians in the war. So so I started, you know, so I researched and found maps of the city that locate, I wanted to really locate this place. Mm-hmm. So there's historic maps, and then there's an amazing scrapbook I found of art projects that a teacher did at the time of Canada's centennial in 1967.
Right.
And they reviewed, they did, like the kids did these projects of like General Givens and the War of 1812 and the one from Schoolhouse and all these things. So it was really interesting to kind of try to wrap my head around who is this figurehead? How did he come to have all this land? How's he been memorialized? Who's been forgotten? Who's left out of this story? What is the real story? How was that story taught 100 years later? And what would happen if we taught it again now?
Mm-hmm.
So it's this idea of the retelling of stories that influenced my work in my vitrines. And it also informed some of the projects the artist made too. So I ended up adding one more artist. So there's five projects altogether. One began as a collaboration and broke into two projects. So in the end, really, there's six. I started with four. It grew. But the artists looked at the archives from a lot of different, you know, very unique perspectives to their practices. Dave Diamond, you know, was fascinated with data, and I thought he'd love all these books and everything like that. But he ended up looking at the school's history when it was closed as a site of filmmaking. And Mean Girls was filmed here, so he did a, he used that as his jumping off point. Nina Levitt looked at collective memory in these class photos and the idea of... she really, her pieces really unpacks many aspects of childhood shame. They're sweet. These very, the stories of childhood is, she was, I think, thinking a lot about the picture day as this really unifying experience for Canadians, whether you just arrived or your parents and family's been here for generations. All the kids of this city get together every year and have their picture taken.
Yes.
And so, so many of us share that memory.
Well, just the school itself, being a school, is something that everybody relates to. So it reverberates on so many levels, all these things.
The other project, the other area of the building they wanted me to program were these wonderful big stairwells. They're quite large. They and they're really interesting spaces to think about as a curator. Like, what is a stairwell and how do you curate a stairwell? Back in the day when I taught art, we used to hang a lot of stuff in the stairwells too. So I was thinking about how many pictures you needed to make the stairwell look good. Lots. So the square meters of space that you need to cover is quite big. So, and the timeline I was operating on was insanely short. So they brought me into the project in the beginning of September with the public opening in late November.
Wow.
So it was like, what? And they wanted us to use vinyl. And just as a... no fire code issues, and this idea that we could put it up and take it down was at first a real head scratcher for me. But then I thought, well, you know what? It's almost the ubiquitous museumological language now. Like, vinyl is everywhere.
Yes.
And so I just selected artists that don't use vinyl. Not that it's that many people's primary medium, but the artists that I invited to do interventions in the stairs, and we called that show Stairmasters. Each took a different approach, and they come from different practices. So one, Debbie Adams, is a designer. Seth Scriber is an animator and filmmaker, and he makes drawings. And then Melissa Fisher is an installation artist who has a very tactile practice in terms of materials. So they were all kind of launching into new territory and incredibly successful what they've done. I'm just completely thrilled.
Yes.
You can hear the bell of the school out the window here. So the Stairmasters... I was thinking of stairs as places that are public. Yes. It's not like a classroom or, you know, it's a place where you go and it's sort of this liminal in-between connective tissue of a building. And although it's public, you're often alone in the stairs. And so this sort of passageway place between. Anyway, the projects they've done are fantastic in the stairs. It was really exciting.
And very much... all of them seem to draw you into a journey, going
yes.
up and down the stairs. There's sort of storylines that that take you from one place to the next.
I wanted to get artists that would engage with the sort of time travel side of mm-hmm. stairs, but I was also really mindful of the fact that now that this building is up and in full operation, it's busy. There's
yes.
like sketches. There's many interesting art organizations and independent studios in the building. So some people, you know, go this way or that way. People are going to enter both the Stairmasters and Unarchived show in all different access points.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of an interesting thing.
Yes.
One of the pieces sets is called Uki Uki's Trip or Nude Ball Descending the Stairs, and it's this really funny animated head figure falling, boinging down the stairs, and it's
poor thing.
Yes, it's delightful and tragic, and he just has this inclination towards the mishap and the misfit, and
yes.
And also all of the artists in the stairwells also address the pedagogical past of this building in very different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Debbie Adams has used flashcards from the 50s as the basis for her project, and Melissa has used a very it's very stark black and white design, and of course that
I love that.
Oh,
it's
amazing.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, and really labor intensive, and my God, they were up
beautiful.
Multiple levels of scaffolding. It was quite
yes.
a feat.
So now, returning to your work,
yes,
I'd love to hear about this new project that you're working on. I know you've got quite a history of working in non-traditional art spaces, or taking public spaces and making them into art spaces. And I'm thinking about the train station, Union Station, which is an incredibly huge. Beautiful space, and now you've got a project coming up that you're deep into
mm-hmm.
that is at BCE Place, another great space. Can you tell me a little bit about that project and how it got going?
Well, it's an amazing space indeed. It's huge. It's designed by Santiago Calatrava, and it's for people that don't come to Toronto often, it is one of the sort of iconic Toronto spaces.
Mm-hmm.
It's these enormous
cathedral-like. Yes.
So I was kind of joking with a friend. It's almost like the Toronto temple of capitalist, you know, endeavor. It's a connective space between huge office towers in downtown Toronto.
But there's on either side, or at least on one side, it's sort of like it. I think it was an old street, and it's
yes.
and it's connecting some old buildings,
yeah.
like old bank buildings.
An old bank building,
yes.
yeah. It's really dynamic in that way. It
mm-hmm.
actually was a street. You're right. So the towers are where you would expect towers to be, but there had been a street there that's now completely indoors. So it's that wide and very very high.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Brookfield Place now, the Alan Lambricht Galleria.
Ah.
And that piece, well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Union Station, because that was a Nuit Blanche project in 2009, and that zone, it goes in zones, so the curators, Jennifer Fisher and Jim Drobnik, had invited me to work, and we were wandering around that downtown core and looking for spaces and trying to figure it out, and I first came up with the idea that's now finally happening at Brookfield Place for that Nuit Blanche,
mm-hmm.
but we never got the right kind of space for it, and they'd
mm-hmm.
been lobbying the city to try to get a hold of Union Station, and
mm-hmm.
when it seemed that we could get it, of course, that was just an irresistible, unbelievable room.
That was a sound...
It was sound-based, because in the end of the day, like, we decided not to make an object.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make a sound intervention in the room, and I had thought of making a giant skirt mm-hmm. that was also like a gramophone. Mm-hmm. And this idea of the announcer and the multitudes of voices in that mm-hmm. space all projecting. But instead, I went and made an immersive sound piece. Mm-hmm. So there was sound coming from multiple speakers all over the room.
Yes.
But meanwhile, I had this sort of giant dress idea. Mm-hmm. And so Robert Vandenberg had seen sketches and plans for that piece and has invited me to realize it now.
And who's Robert Vandenberg?
He is an art consultant mm-hmm. who just started working with various properties that have had experiences with things like Luminato Festival or Nuit Blanche. And he's interested in the idea of these kinds of short-term things, but maybe extending them somewhere between the permanent art installation that's mm-hmm. made of metal and forever,
yes.
and these very temporal things that go up sometimes for a week or a month,
right.
or night for Nuit Blanche. And working with property holders that have these kinds of spaces that want to activate them more.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the one who's bringing this together.
Right.
It's not going to have a sound element in the end, but it will be kinetic, and it's going to be five huge skirts.
So what is this about skirts? I've noticed that's a theme that's come through over the years.
It's true. Well, they're usually skirts you can look up, I suppose. being underneath a big skirt. Well, I guess they're kind of tent-like,
yeah.
and they kind of have a childlike thing. I love sort of playing with shifts of scale, that the Lilliputian, the giganticness. I think in this instance, it's going to be like some kind of fembomb, encounter in this kind of cold space.
Yes.
I first used skirts with a piece called Pick Me.
Yes,
that I'd done.
I love that.
Oh, thank
yes.
you so much. It's that one's illuminated, and
yes.
it's made with real prom gowns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been cited in lots of different places, but that one is, it's sort of about the sort of delight, in a way, of the childhood vision of the woman. It mm-hmm. certainly was my childhood when I wanted to be a ballerina, and
yes.
this sort of super larger-than-life...
princess now.
Yeah, my grandmother, sort of was always putting perfume on me mm-hmm. and all that. It's a provocative thing for me, because, of course, I'm super ambivalent about this idea of the feminine and mm-hmm. Where does that fit into my reality. I think it's fun for me, it's a playful gesture, I think, to just juxtapose this kind of completely oversized feminine into different kind of spaces mm-hmm. and to see what it could be. This piece is, I think, a little inspired by dance as well. They're going to be moving, not mm-hmm. super fast swirling around and around, but swaying. Maybe it's the wind that's making them move, but it's going to be more than that. So it's kind of like semi-alive. A lot of things that I make over the years, people have been like, oh, it looks like it. They almost seem like they want to talk or dance or do something, which is what made me start making sound-based works.
Mm-hmm.
The pieces started whispering, and they just seem to be calling forth a voice.
Well, I have to say that... I did see an opera in the train station a few years ago, and I found the sound, because it was sort of an opera, you expect good sound, and there was so much reverberation.
Yeah.
But with your sound piece, you worked with that reverberation, and so it was sort of incorporated that reality into your work, and made the space come alive in a way that you weren't really fighting
uh-huh.
As you were there to absorb the piece.
It was fascinating to see people, when they came in, lay on the ground. That was totally unexpected to us.
Mm.
I had all kinds of light activity going on the ceiling
yes.
and throughout the room, and then we also had a fog machine that would sort of create these big blasts of fog now and then. So I kind of thought people would walk around, but they ended up lying down. It was fascinating, I think, just to let it all wash over the body or something.
And Nuit Blanche, people, it's sort of a time where people can act out of the ordinary, so they probably felt they had permission to do something that they've always wanted to do, is lie down and look up at that grand ceiling. And yeah. So sorry, I interrupted your about the Brookfield.
Well, we'll see how it goes. This is the first kinetic piece that I've done, and Yeah, it's hard to talk about things in some ways when they're still on the go. But I'm very excited about it. They're going to range in size. I mean, the hemlines are going to be sort of in the 90-foot range. So they're, you know, 25 feet sort of high. They're big. I had made a piece, a mid-sized piece, between the prom gown work of Pick Me and this. I'd done some work with parachutes as a sort of larger skirt. Those were... that was audio based still. But this past summer, when Robert first talked to me about doing something in Brookfield Place, I was about to go away for the summer and I went in there. I've been in there before, but I kind of went in there with the new hat on, like, I'm going to do something here. And of course, my jaw dropped on the floor. It's huge.
Enormous.
And while I was in BC, I was really fortunate to be able to access a decommissioned hot air balloon. And I and a pickup truck in a field where I could actually pull the thing around and kind of start to play with it, because I'm very tactile, and it was a little hard to figure it out. And it really helped me kind of get a sense of, like, how big
actual space.
Yeah,
yes.
How big a diameter am I looking at here to give people that feeling of magic.
Yes.
And then there's an enormous height there. So I'm going to vary their placement. Some of them are going to be way high. And some will be kind of down closer to above your head in feel.
So this this is something that's actually going to go on tour. And how does that work, going on tour and figuring out all that size and et cetera? How does...
Well, when they told me that, I did reconsider the size of them somewhat. And we are designing them so that they could be various heights.
Right.
Because at Brookfield Place, there's like 75 feet. Like, it's very, very high. Another site that Brookfield Properties owns or manages, I don't even know how it goes.
So it's going to all properties owned by
Brookfield. By them. Yeah, they've commissioned it. So they have the Winter Garden in New York.
Right.
So I know that space well. And it's not as tall. And there's palm trees in it and all sorts of stuff. So I'm trying to figure out, like, oh my God, how will they go there? Well, we've designed them so that they could be sort of perkier type...
Yes.
Shapes. They could be shorter that would therefore make them wider, a little more Maryland looking. These ones are slightly more ball gowny looking. Last year Luminato brought the Luminato Festival in Toronto brought Mark Morris's piece, The Rites of Spring, I think it's called, up Allegra, and I wish I knew what I was talking about as I talk about it. Anyway, it was an amazing piece, though, in terms of costume design.
Yes.
This idea, I like working, I often find myself creating groups of objects, and I love to play with this idea of being part of and being separate from, being sort of going, like with that, for instance, the prom piece, you know, kind of wanting to have an outfit that will be both standing out, but not too much.
Yes.
This piece is really looking in that as well. So I'm pretty fascinated with the idea of color choice in clothing or in costuming as these sort of indicators of identity. The red, you know, the bright pink one versus the sort of teal or the gray, different ideas of personality and presentation and the way we kind of construct our identity with these kinds of choices.
So when you're looking up at these skirts, what are you going to see? Just out of curiosity, but if you look
on the inside,
on the inside, I sense that feeling of almost protection or something of these large sort of skirt shapes. But
the inside will be kind of like pod shapes that will go around the interior of the waist and come down, and they're going to have a little bit of a kind of bloomers feel,
right?
Or a little bit of a playful kind of undergarment feel to them. But they'll be up there, kind of, you know, like they're not as low as the hemline,
right?
So they're going to be kind of up there. They'll serve to block,
cover the mechanisms.
Yeah, to cover the mechanisms, and they'll also sway and move with the piece. So I had a similar kind of pod type thing inside of a number of skirt-like forms that I've made, and it sort of becomes the, it kind of embodies kind of ideas of sexuality and private places and all this kind of stuff too.
Yes.
So those are going to be fun to make. We're going to make a prototype quite soon. So we'll have the first of these large skirts there, and then I'm going to play with some different ideas.
So are you going to do the prototype to size?
Yes.
And then put it up there?
Not there. We're going to do it somewhere else. It looks like we're going to use some aircraft carriers up at Downsview.
Right.
And then we can just use it with a hoist, so we can put it up and down. We're going to test the motoring to make sure the speed is just right. I don't want it to feel like a ride at the X where it goes off and on.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to mimic some sort of, we'll just play with the programming.
Sort of
it's amazing.
Dance.
Yeah,
kind of
a
thing.
Little bit fluid and a little bit, some of the sounds that I've made are of maybe people alone in their bedroom or in their bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somewhere between the public and the private.
Yes.
You know, like maybe practicing what you might say or sing or,
yes.
Maybe sounds you're making when nobody's listening.
Mm-hmm.
So I want the movements to feel a bit like that too. Like I don't want it to feel like they're all in consort and they know what they're doing. It's going to be more like maybe Wallflowers, kind of hoping to get asked to dance.
Uh-huh. and doing a little show-off gesture draw someone in.
The way little girls sometimes will kind of sway their skirt to see what it does if they're like waiting somewhere and they just start kind of shifting their hips and it just starts to see what happens. I want it to feel like that. And each one a little different.
Yes. Wow. Interesting.
I hope so. I'm nervous.
So, just before we finish, is there anything else that you would like to share with the audience from around the world working in public spaces and what draws you to that as opposed to traditional galleries? So I know you do show in galleries as well.
Not as often. I think part of what it is I think part of what it's been about is loving architecture and urban spaces.
Yes.
So they ignite my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think the independent curating and sort of larger programming things that I've done in outdoor types of spaces, they kind of engage with a public that isn't necessarily the gallery going public. And that's part of what's been really fun in this building. My studio's now in this Artscape building where we're sitting. And every time I go out in the hall, there's all kinds of people looking at these shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had so many fantastic conversations. And whenever I've done art in public places, I really do enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. I did notice a couple of kids downstairs really getting into looking at the clay heads.
So that's part of it for sure. And then I think also, though, like sometimes when I teach, I like to sort of remind students that you don't have to spend all your time trying to go to a party you're not invited to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's something sometimes that can feel a little impenetrable and baffling about the sort of the system or the gallery or the famous curator or whatever. I don't know. I don't know how to do that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really just blah. So sometimes through doing things that I want.
Yes.
People get into it, and then it feels like that's how things have happened for me in my practice more, like making things happen, and then something else comes out of it.
Yes.
It feels like the not direct route, but it's the way it works for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so many ways to be an artist.
Yeah.
And I'd like to thank you so much for being here, Heather, and taking the time for this interview.
It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.